If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
All right, Valentine's Day is also comedian Waukegan's very own Jack Benny's birthday. For nearly half a century, Benny kept audiences in stitches with his alter ego of vain Penny Pincher, who was forever 39 and delusional about his skill at playing the violin. After appearing in vaudeville and radio and the movies, his popular radio cities, the Jack Benny. His popular radio series, The Jack Benny Program, took to television in 1950. And by the way, this is the 75th anniversary of Jack Benny's premiere on television. Benny kept active until his death until 1974 at the age of 80, and he left us over 50 years ago. Jack was still headlining live concerts, doing TV specials, and appearing on all the talk shows. He was a particular favorite of Johnny Carson with his peerless sense of timing. And he is just very much remembered on this day. February is always Jack Benny month for Steve as we celebrate the 135th anniversary of Jack's birth. And to talk about the legacy of this entertainment icon and Nostalgia Digest magazine is Steve Darnell. Steve, how are you?
Lovely, David. How are you?
I am great. Jack is iconic, born in Chicago, grew up in Waukegan. You know, in 1911, he began playing the violin in local vaudeville theaters. I mean, this guy entertained us for nearly a century.
Yes, and it's worth noting that when he started out, he actually was a serious violin player. He actually did a credible job on stage. But what happened, as I understand it, is during the First World War, he was up at Great Lakes Naval Training Center and got roped into doing a show with a fellow mate named Pat O'Brien. And then found out he could be funny. So when he came back to performing, it was less as a violinist and more as the brilliantly dry comedian whose violin playing wasn't nearly as proficient.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing what he was able to do. And he was a broadcasting pioneer. And as you point out, just really understood how to work an audience, you know, and that's a rare talent. And also really one of the first comedians to make himself the butt of every joke.
That's right. To be self-deprecating is a rare form for a comedian, you know?
Oh, yeah. Most comedians will tell you they get into this so that people will laugh at the things they do and say. Jack realized that on radio and on television, too, if it's the Jack Benny program, the important thing is that the show is funny. Whether Jack's the one being funny or whether it's one of his cast or whether it's a guest star, because it would reflect well on him, and then you and I would go to work the next day and say, "Hey, didn't you hear Jack Benny last night? He was great."
Right. That was the viral moment at the time. Was it the water cooler? It's very true. It's very true. He signed on to MGM a five-year contract, you know, which his first role was in the Hollywood Review of 1929. The movies really weren't his thing, but in the early 30s, 1932, after a four-week nightclub run, he was invited onto Ed Sullivan's radio program. And I know that sounds odd to some people because Sullivan was big in the late 40s, 50s, 60s, and the early 70s on television. But it was the 1930s that Ed made his debut. Mm-hmm. And Jack Benny made his first appearance on that program. This is Jack Benny talking. There will be a slight pause while you say, "Who cares?" And the rest was history. Right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, even then. And I there's one other joke that I absolutely love that he said, I think, that he'd been in Hollywood because there's a lot of money in motion pictures, or they would be if I was making one.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, you are the expert on this. Like, talk to me about the legacy of Jack on radio, because he lasted 1932 really to 1955 on two major networks.
Yeah, I think Jack was obviously an outstanding comedian in that he had a great understanding of timing. His writers would tell you he wasn't funny as such, but he was a very good editor of comedy writing. And that's important when you're working in a scripted medium like radio to realize that, yes, there's a difference between this word and that word. This word will be funnier when I say it. That's a rare skill to have. The other thing about Jack is he was also, as we said, he was something of a broadcasting pioneer. And I'm always impressed by this because apparently Jack and his wife, Mary Livingston, who was also part of the show for many years, they would listen to comedians they liked, people like Ed Wynn and Eddie Cantor. And Jack noticed those comedians might tell a joke that wasn't, that got a reaction that was out of proportion to the quality of the joke. Not that the joke wasn't good, but the audience on at the radio studio was just laughing uproariously at what was not an uproarious joke. And Jack realized that these comedians were still acting like they were on a stage in a vaudeville house where you do and say anything to get people to laugh. Jack realized people like you and I who are listening at home are missing all that.
Right, right.
So Jack realized radio needed to be a more intimate sort of comedy. And that's why he and his writers began playing with the form. You know, even in the very early days when Jack was on the air for Canada Dry, and he did a commercial for Canada Dry in which he offered to take the singer on the program, Ethel Shute, out for a ginger ale. And, you know, and even then he was telling the jokes like, I'll pay for mine.
yeah.
But, you know, they had him, you know, talking about, oh, listen to it, Fizz, here, listen to the Ice Cubes. And then he'd say, well, we're back now from the drugstore. And to tell you the truth, we never left. We've been here all this time.
Well, and it's funny, too, because when you're writing for radio, I mean, and they were figuring out as they were going along. I mean, it's very different because you have to give the audience, because every audience member that is listening to any radio show, it's a theater of the mind. Everyone sees something different. They see a different set. But he had to really establish that so differently. And then when he finally went to television 75 years ago in 1950, you almost had to recreate and go back to the vaudeville days where you knew people could see you for that level of comedy and make a whole different impact with the audience.
Absolutely. As you point out, Jack had worked in radio for many years and had built up this sort of repertoire, not only in terms of his cast, but also in terms of things like Mel Blanc as the broken down Maxwell automobile and the underground vault with the moats and the drawbridge. And as one of Jack's writers, I think Milt Josephsberg, pointed out, you know, 10 different people had 10 different ideas of what the underground vault looked like. And when they did it on television, it didn't match any of them.
Right.
You know,
right.
Then you were just struck by, gee, what a cheap-looking set. And that's a very different thing. So you're right. Jack had to invent himself for radio and then reinvent himself in television as a master of ceremonies and comedian. So Some of the things, you know, they do situation comedy, and that's fairly easy to do on television. But even when they were just doing sort of straight entertainment and variety, they were playing with the form. I remember there's an episode of Jack's television show, and his guest is Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And the conceit behind the program is that Tennessee Ernie can't make it to the studio, but they're doing a split screen. So he's up at his ranch, wherever that is, and Jack's in the studio. And Tennessee starts to play a song, and Jack's going to accompany him on the violin. Well, eventually what happens is their positions on the split screen are reversed, and then suddenly their clothes are reversed. And then one of them's upside down, and the other... I mean, it's just insane what they were doing. And they realized, you know, there were still things you could do once you figured out how this particular toolbox worked. And, you know, it helped, of course, that they had this comedian who was very, very skilled at what he did. So, you know, knowing that you've got Jack Benny as your anchor, that probably frees you up to try a whole lot of interesting and fun things.
Well, and there's also, by the way, a lot of shows that did not transfer well from radio to television. Fibber McGee and Molly, some of these other shows just really didn't make the same impact. But Jack could do it. And Jack did it really on television until he died almost 25 years later, whether it was a special or the show. He just had that talent to do that.
Oh, absolutely. And like I say, he was adaptable to just about any situation. You know, if you were doing something situation comedy style, like his guest appearance on the Lucy Show,
right,
he could do that. If you're doing a 60-minute primetime special, which he did for a number of years, you know, he could do that where he introduces, you know, Nancy Sinatra and then does a sketch with Gregory Peck and so on and so on. Yeah, I think, and of course, he was also of that generation where you went where the work was, and you did what had to be due to make the check. And not to say he pandered, not to say he may have done things he didn't want to do, although I doubt that. You know, he was the guy in charge, but, you know, he also understood his obligation was to entertain people, and, you know, if you can do that, they'll cut you a lot of slack.
That's true. That's true. And back in the day, too, as you know, I mean, the sponsors, if you didn't have a sponsor, you weren't doing a show, really. So, you know, it was the early days in the 30s. It was General Foods, you know, and they agreed to take up sponsorship from a struggling tire maker to promote its low-selling Jell-O desserts. And then in the 40s, due to a sugar shortage during wartime, General Foods switched their sponsor to from Jell-O to Grape Nuts. It's just amazing to me when you look back at that era. You know, they pretty much paid for the show and put the show on the air. Sponsors were such a thing, and Jack always had them.
He did, and we talked about Jack as a radio innovator, and one of the ways he was an innovator is from the beginning, he insisted on incorporating comedy into the commercials. And so this goes back to 1932 when he was on the air for Canada Dry, and he literally told the story about a girlfriend whose uncle had been to every night spot in New York, and now he was going north to drink Canada Dry.
Right. And it's right. Sorry. Took me a minute, but yes, exactly.
Yeah, and of course, they got a lot better with that over time. But the fact was, in early 1930s radio, there were a number of sponsors who weren't entirely comfortable with that idea. And right. Canada Dry was one. Chevrolet, who sponsored Jack briefly, was another. By the time Jell-O came around, as you point out, they were struggling. They were losing out to, I believe it was Knox Gelatin.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so they were sort of in a position, they weren't in a position to make hard and fast demands on an established radio comedian. So they incorporated comedy into the middle commercials. It worked. The sales took off. And it, that in turn started a wave of that sort of thing happening. That's the sort of thing that Bill Goodwin did on the Burns and Allen show. And, of course, Harlow Wilcox did it on Fibber McGee and Molly, where he'd drop by the McGees and somehow steer the conversation around to Johnson's Wax.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Steve Darnall is the editor-in-chief of Nostalgia Digest magazine. What's the price for the magazine right now, Steve, and how can folks get it?
Well, the easiest way to get it is to visit our website at nostalgiadigest.com. And if you don't have a computer, you can call our offices at 773-769-6575. A one-year subscription will bring you four issues, print and digital, on a quarterly basis, for $19, and a two-year subscription is eight issues for $34. And, of course, it's perfect for any of you who are still thinking it's time to get something for Valentine's Day.
I love it. More with Steve after the news next on 720 WGN. All right, we're talking to Steve Darnall of Nostalgia Digest magazine. The winter edition is available now at nostalgiadigest.com. The winter issue has a cover story about film legend Lionel Barrymore. This issue also features articles about actress Judy Holliday, the history of Pez Candy, radio's Easy Aces, and a lot more. Let's talk about Judy Holliday a little bit. She's been gone for more than 60 years, but she left quite a legacy.
She really did. I mean, it's sort of astonishing that how brief her career was, and tragically how brief her life was. But she was one of those performers who, I think, really, from all reports, really lit up the space she was in, and one of those who I think could be, as the writer of the article in this winter issue points out, she could make funny lines sound like she was just thinking them up. Yeah. And that's the sign of a pretty good actress. And many people, of course, will remember Judy Holliday because she played in the play and the film Born Yesterday, and which she plays this sort of this woman who you might treat as a stereotypical dumb, dizzy blonde, but she eventually learns to seek out knowledge and to speak for herself, and she becomes a very powerful character. And she won an Oscar when she did the movie version of it. And I think of this because a few years later, she was called up before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And she didn't want to name names and didn't want to be in that position of having to, you know, sell out friends or strangers for that matter. So she went before the HUAC playing the character she played in Born Yesterday.
Wow.
And pulled it off. You know, it was sort of like she managed to come out of that sort of like, I suppose if Gracie Allen had gone before on the witness stand at a trial, it's like you leave a little more confused than when you came in.
It's true. Yeah.
So in a way, it was sort of a remarkable acting job she did. But yes, as a singer and as an actress, you can see some of her films. It's also worth noting she did, I guess, a lot of really great work on the stage, and regrettably, that's lost to us now.
Another story you have in here is about Pez. It was invented in Austria 98 years ago. That has a really interesting story as well.
Yes. I was fascinated. And this is one of the things I love about publishing Nostalgia Digest, David, is because people will send us articles about the past. But as you are finding, as you're explaining to your audience, the past is a huge place.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
So it's nice that, yes, we can have an article about Judy Holliday next to an article about Pez Candy. Not two things you'd necessarily put together otherwise. But yeah, Pez, as I understand it, was sort of created as a peppermint candy.
Yes.
The idea being it would be an alternative to smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually someone had the idea that you could flavor these in different ways, market them to children, and then in the 1950s, somebody had the idea of
the dispensers.
The dispenser, yes,
yeah.
Where you basically you stack them up, you put a little cartoon head on the top, you lift it up, out comes your candy, and my goodness, people are still buying those and still collecting those some 70 years later.
Oh, that's
astonishing, and the fact is, yeah, that. We often talk about the definition of nostalgia, and I've often said for our purposes, nostalgia is something that used to be one way and now it isn't. But Pez, my goodness, that's an example of something that, I mean, it did used to be one way, it changed, now it's something that people are going to be talking about for every year of their lives. You know? It's
first,
kind of amazing.
Well, you said very collectible. First ever licensed character was Popeye, and... Mm-hmm. The most expensive, 1961, it was a Pez candy gifted to President John F. Kennedy with a set of Democratic and Republican Pez dispensers made of ivory.
Oh.
When he visited Austria, and they're valued about $25,000 to $30,000 a piece. So,
wow.
So there you go. There you go.
Yeah, and what's funny about that, I don't think I'm stepping on any toes here, and I don't think I'm saying something that people aren't aware of already. You know, it seems to me if you're going to get a $25,000 Pez dispenser,
yeah,
the candy should be a little better.
Yeah, it probably should be. Probably want to replace that.
I mean, make it out of caviar.
Yeah, something. Something, for sure. Well, and now you've been hosting an old-time radio show yourself on WT's... Let me try that again. Now, you've been hosting an old-time radio show yourself on WDCB for quite some time. Chuck Shaden was the founder, the original host. And you have a big 55th anniversary celebration that's coming up on the campus of the College of DuPage.
Yes, out at the Mackinac Arts Center, Sunday, April 6th. We'll be celebrating the 55th anniversary of Those Were the Days. And we're going to be... presenting sort of a large-scale radio and variety show.
You always do.
Sort of, yeah, sort of similar to what, you know, they would have done during the Golden Age of Radio. So we'll have actors on stage with scripts in hand, recreating some moments from the past. And, of course, Chuck Shaden, who started Those Were the Days, will be joining us as well.
And how do folks get tickets to that?
The easiest way is to go to wdcb.org/twtd55. But if you need to, for those of you without the benefit of a computer, you can call WDCB at 630-942-4200.
And Nostalgia Digest Magazine, get the latest edition and your subscription today. Visit nostalgiadigest.com. Steve, always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you, and we'll see you soon.
David, thanks for your time. Have a great weekend.
You too.